You're listening to the Art of Dying Well podcast, making death and dying something we can all talk about.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Art of Dying Well podcast. Well, it's been a real privilege being able to talk to you every couple of months about so many issues surrounding death and dying. But it has to be said that while so many people are finding they're now able, to some degree, to talk about it, one of life's central topics, of course, many more list death, and particularly dying alone, as their number one anxiety. Now, on today's podcast, we'll be talking about a project designed to make things a little bit easier. End-of-life accompaniment. The Centre for the Art of Dying Well has partnered up with an excellent charity, the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, to work on a new initiative providing end-of-life companions for dying people. The idea being that nobody should die alone, unless, of course, they themselves choose to do so. And we'll start this podcast by picking up on that rather intriguing topic with our first guest. Nobody actually chooses to die alone, right? Wrong, actually. Some people plan very carefully indeed to make sure that they do die alone. But why? Helping us to answer that question is sociologist Dr. Glenys Caswell. Dr. Caswell is from Nottingham University's Centre for the Advancement of Research into Supportive, Palliative and End-of-Life Care. Quite a mouthful that. And joins us down the line now. Glenys, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And thank you so much for inviting me to join you today.
Oh, well, not at all. You seem perfectly placed to talk to us about this because, you know, we make that big presumption that it would be such an awful, dreadful thing if one was to die alone. And I know, obviously, you've spent pretty much a couple of years looking at the social management of lone deaths. So the question, I think, to begin with is, what have you discovered are the reasons that a person might actually choose to die alone?
Now, that's really quite a complicated question to
a big
answer,
question.
I think. I think what I have discovered over the last years while researching dying alone and people's choices and decisions around how they wish to end their lives is that dying alone is actually a very complex thing. When we talk about it in normal everyday conversation, we talk about it as if there's nothing unexpected about it. We know what we're talking about it. When we say someone dies alone, we know what we mean. But once you actually start to look at this and unpick it a bit, I came to realise that in actual fact, there are a number of different ways in which people can die alone. I have carried out more than one research project with the issue of dying alone at its heart. And I've talked to older people who live on their own about their views. I have talked to people who've been bereaved about the experience of someone they cared about dying. I have talked to nurses in particular, and most specifically palliative care nurses who look after people who are dying about their experiences and views around this issue. But I've also talked to people who work in roles such as funeral directors, funeral celebrants, local authority workers, people who deal with the situation where a person has died and they have no one to take charge of the post-death details. There's no one to register the death. There's no one to organise a funeral. And I've also carried out some documentary analysis of things such as, for example, coroner cases where someone's died alone at home and their body hasn't been found for an extended period of time. And also a news media review. And looking at all the data from these different groups, I've come to realise that there are various different ways in which people can be said to die alone. Now, I'm not putting these forward as kind of fixed groups or fixed categories. There is very much a kind of a overlap between categories, and there's very much a porous boundary between the different groupings. The first one I'd like to describe is what I call a lone death. And that's where someone lives on their own, has lived on their own for quite a long time. They have virtually no social contacts, perhaps no family, or the family have moved away, or they've lost contact with them. And when they die, their body is not found for a very long time, sometimes even a period of years. And cases like this, of course, are reported in the newspaper. And the ones that I call lone death have occurred when the body is found, not because someone has noticed they are missing, but because bailiffs have come to the house, most likely because of unpaid bills, possibly because of something like a water leak or some kind of structural issue with the accommodation. These I call lone deaths. They are rare, but they do happen. I tend to think of people who have died in this way, of people who have already, before their biological death, have taken themselves through a process almost of social death, where they have withdrawn from society, where they have no social agency any longer, so that when they cease going out and about, when they cease doing the things that they normally did, no one actually notices. And that's how it comes about that it can be a really long time before their body is found. I think it's the immediate human reaction, isn't it, to think, that's terrible, that's awful. But I'm not so sure that it's terrible or awful for the person in that situation. There was one case in particular, and this was a case which initially sparked off my interest in this kind of topic. And it was a case of a retired nurse who had died. She wasn't found, I think, for about 5 years, because, of course, it can be quite difficult to judge how long it is. And she was found because of a water leak in her flat, which went through into the flat below. And when I was thinking about it and reading the coverage, which was just as we've been describing, what came into my head was, well, perhaps when she felt unwell, as a nurse who'd worked in the big local hospital, she knew what it would mean if she was to summon help and she was perhaps taken to the emergency department. It was perhaps better for her as a private person to stay at home rather than die on a trolley in the local A&E. And it may not have mattered to her what happened to her body after death.
That's very interesting, because you could also, could you not, equate that to a hospice as well? Maybe that particular person may have felt, well, I don't want a sort of long death, being cared for, not being able to do anything for myself. I'd rather have those things contained in a home setting. Is it the home setting that's key to this?
If I refer to some of the interviews I have done with older people who live on their own, obviously people have different views, but there was a group of 13 interviews that I did, and there was a kind of a subset within that of three or four people who felt that dying wasn't the worst thing that could happen to them. And for some people, this is the three or four people I referred to, they felt that it would be better to die alone at home, and they weren't too worried how long it was before their body was found. That to them was preferable to becoming engaged in the healthcare system, in being, as they viewed it, potentially forced to go into a care home. So for them, it wasn't a big issue. Other people, of course, in the group were concerned about how long it would be before their body was found. Some took preemptive measures, like having milk delivered, in the view that the person delivering the milk would notice if it was left on the doorstep.
That's interesting. It makes me wonder I'm no expert, but whether the sort of living wills type of sort of pre-planning approach comes in here, whereas one must completely respect somebody that wishes to die that way, may not want to be accompanied, may be a private person, as you say. But it is quite gruesome if you discover that person and you're not ready for it, if you like, or if there's an emergency situation with leakage from a flat above or something like that, or they're, you know, literally right behind a door and people can't get through the door, that sort of thing. Do you think maybe the solution to that, whilst respecting their wishes, is to have this sort of, I don't know, plan whereby the authorities or statutory people, or there would be a checking mechanism every now and again without intruding on their privacy? Or is that rather fanciful on my part?
I can see the attraction of that. And for some people, I think perhaps the idea of some kind of advance directive might be a good thing. It might answer their needs. But I think one thing I would say with regard to that is that the study you initially referred to, the one, it was funded by the Leverhulme Trust that has only recently finished. We put together in that a number of case studies of people who had died alone at home and not been found for an extended period of time. Now, a couple of those, it had been years, and we've already spoken about the sort of lone death. But for most of the people, their bodies were found after a period of a couple of days up to 2 or 3 months. One of the things that was interesting about this group of people is that they were none of them especially old. The oldest person was, I think, 73. And it was interesting, too, that there was very little engagement. They had very little engagement with the health services. For example, one of the men had been seeing his GP because of high blood pressure, I think it was. But he'd reported to his GP that he found taking the medication very difficult. He stopped ordering repeat prescriptions. So after he had died several years later, something like 8 years later, his GP in his report to the coroner had said that they presumed that he had stopped taking the medication. So while I can see the attraction of a system whereby there's a possibility of checking in on people and a possibility of people having a system in place which details what they might be willing to have in terms of care and support or what they might not be willing to have, I can't put any numbers on this, but I think for a large number of people in this situation, they just don't engage with services. They are kind of flying under the radar, if you will. GP services, social services are not particularly aware of them.
Yeah. And I guess really with that, we're sort of talking, because most of the study took place, I think, from August 2018 through to July 2020. Mm-hmm. But then July 2020 is a good, you know, we'd had a period of lockdown then. Our social circumstances had changed, obviously, by virtue of distanced isolation and the need to stop the spread of COVID. What changes did you notice towards the tail end of that study were brought about because of COVID? Because, you know, if people want to be on their own anyway, and they're choosing that way, did COVID change anything? Or was it almost invisible, as far as you can tell, just with that particular small period in mind?
Well, I think as far as the study we're talking about here is concerned, I think COVID didn't make any difference in that we were looking back on deaths that had occurred previously. So all the deaths that formed part of our case studies had occurred before the coronavirus pandemic began. It's interesting you mention this because, as I said earlier, there are several groupings that I've identified when it comes to dying alone. And the group of people who are found after sort of days or weeks, I call them dying alone at home, where they live alone, they die alone at home, and they're found a bit later, but they're found because somebody notices that they're missing. So it might be a neighbour who notices that they haven't been putting the bins out or going to the shop. So somebody comes and finds them. Then there's a grouping of people who choose to die alone and sort of take active steps for that to occur. Then there are people who are alone at the moment that they die. And this is, I think, probably the largest group of people who die on their own, in the sense that if you talk to people who support dying people, nurses in particular, they will tell you so many stories about how the family are keeping vigil around the bed, supporting the person talking to them, and then the family go away to get a cup of tea or to make a phone call, and the person dies. And that is so common. The last grouping that I've identified is what I'm calling lonely dying. Now, that builds on the work of Norbert Elias, the sociologist Norbert Elias, and that of Alan Kelleher. A situation where somebody may be surrounded by people, but they're not the right people. So that they're dying surrounded by people, so they're not dying alone technically, but they feel as if they're alone. They feel lonely. And it's very much struck me, particularly in the early days of the pandemic, when people were dying in hospital, surrounded by people, but people wearing what must, if you're confused and distressed, potentially look like, you know, spaceman garments. all the PPE and with no family members there, that probably lonely dying is the thing that would be most pertinent and obviously is the thing that is concerning for families. And of course, as time passed, hospitals, nurses, doctors put a lot of effort into trying to find ways to alleviate that situation, whether it's through the use of technology when it's working or having a designated nurse to sit with the person. But I think lonely dying is a difficult category because there's only one person who knows the dying person is feeling lonely. And of course, we're not in a position, we can't ask them questions about that.
Do you know, it's fascinating to talk to you, particularly from that social management side, because, and I talk about this sometimes on the programme, but I remember when my brother died at 24, this was in Gloucestershire, I was in London, so it was a bit of to-ing and fro-ing because one of my children was being born at the time, both ends of life. And I remember when finally it got to that moment in a palliative care situation, which of course, as you know, is very hard to predict when the actual moment of dying will occur. And I thought to myself, was I there in time? I seem to be there in time. I'm not sure if I was there in time. I think he hung on for me. You know, we say those things, don't we, as well, that type of thing. You've got me thinking a bit, especially with that distinction between being alone and being lonely, even potentially with people around you. I suppose even through my own experience, it's got me thinking that the dying person, in a sense as well, perhaps, feels the pressure of having to die in a certain way because of the people around them. Do you think that's true?
I think that is a possibility. It's so hard to know, isn't it? But talking to palliative care nurses about the situation we've spoken about, you know, where the family are present, they leave the bedside and the person dies. Some nurses will say that they believe that within a limited extent, the person has some choice about when they die. And it can be almost a release of tension when the family leave the bedside, as if the family are holding them in life rather than allowing them to go. And of course, some people do explicitly say to someone they care about who is dying, you know, it's okay for you to go now.
Yeah, that permission type of
thing. Yes.
Oh, that's fascinating. And do you know what, Glenys? I could talk to you for hours and hours with the breadth of your study and experience. Absolutely fascinating. But I'm going to ask you one question, which I hope you don't deem unfair, because it's not directly related to this. But obviously, as the art of dying well, we're always talking about what actually dying well means, what it is. So as a sociologist, I just wanted to ask you, you know, what do you consider to be dying well?
Oh, that is such a huge question.
That's why I said unfair, potentially. Does it? I grant you that. It is a very tough question.
Yes. I mean, I think it's one of those things that very much depends on the people involved. Well, as a sociologist, obviously, I see the group of people rather than just the individual. And when you think about how we make decisions, so often we might be making a decision about ourselves and our own health and potentially our own death. But we do tend to make decisions in a relational way in which we consider the people around us. So I think dying well or a good death, I think it very much depends on the people involved. And I think it depends on so many different aspects of their lives. We can sometimes, I think, forget that death is much more than a medical event. We can become focused very much on ensuring that somebody has the medical and nursing care they need. And obviously that is so important. And the medical profession these days has so much to offer dying people. And pain relief, physical pain relief, is so important. But there are also other things going on, because when an individual dies, unless they have kind of withdrawn themselves from society, that death is going to affect so many people. And I think dying well needs to take account of that fact, and it needs to happen in a way that is good for all the people who are most closely involved. And I think one of the problems that we have is that because we don't talk about it very much, we don't always necessarily know what those around us would want, what they would prefer. And of course, it's the case, isn't it, that when we're thinking about potentially our own deaths, we want to spare the people we care about suffering. So we might make decisions not based on what we ourselves would want, but on what we think might be best for the people around us. I think if we were able to have open, honest conversations with each other about what would be best, for example, dying at home, it's thought, and surveys tend to support this view, that people prefer to die at home. But then as people come closer to the end of their lives, you know, perhaps as they become older, perhaps they become frail, and perhaps they have some kind of terminal illness diagnosis, their view might change because they might be worried about their partner living in that house after they've died there. They might be worried about the effect on their partner or their children of having to look after them. They're seeing their potential death in that space and the effect it might have on the people around them. And I think it's different for different people.
Yeah, very true. Very true. And thank you for taking that on. I appreciate that was my and finally question. Well, look, Dr. Glenys Caswell, thank you so much for helping us understand lone deaths a little bit better and to move outside our preconceptions and our projections and to understand about being alone versus being lonely. I think it's been absolutely fascinating. And thank you for bearing with me in this technologically fraught era where we have to do all manner of things to talk to one another. So for our listeners, if you hear a bit of an echo there, that's because we've been to-ing and fro-ing, haven't we, Glenys, to get this to you. But thank you ever so much. Do stay in touch with us. I'm sure we'll be back in touch with you to tap on your expertise again, if you don't mind. That would be great.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak about my work.
And fascinating work it is too. I'm sure you'll all agree. I don't know, maybe you can pick this up, maybe you can't, but there's a little bird tweeting in the background. So if that's in any way distracting, I do apologise. But then again, it's one of those uplifting aspects of nature. So maybe in these times you'll excuse that. Big, big thank you to Dr. Glenys Caswell there for opening our eyes to lone deaths and why people find themselves treading that path at the end of life. If you find yourself listening to this and have a point to make, or just more generally want to get in touch with us here at the Centre for the Art of Dying Well, we'd be really happy to hear from you. And here's just how you can do it.
To let us know what you think, follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook using @ArtOfDyingWell. Or you can check out our website, artofdyingwell.org.
Now, at the top of the show, you may remember I mentioned an excellent new initiative from the Centre for the Art of Dying Well and the wonderful charity, the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. The idea is to provide more widely end-of-life companions for dying people. Time to find out a little more now, and to do so, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by our good friend, Dr. Lynn Bassett. I'm sure you'll remember that Lynn has, on more than one occasion, provided the voice from the chaplain's chair. Lynn was a healthcare chaplain for some 14 years, working in acute and particularly palliative care settings, and has a doctorate in silence in spiritual care at the end of life. Something I've spoken to you about before, Lynn. Hello. How are you to start with?
Hello, I'm very well, James.
Now, we're today going to talk about a really interesting end-of-life companionship programme that the Art of Dying Well is working on in conjunction with the SVP, the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, who I know have got wide experience in this type of thing. And Lynn, you've been working on that programme, producing a bit of training. Tell us a little bit about the programme as you see it at the moment.
Yeah, we're really excited about this initiative. Prior to the pandemic, I think about a third of hospitals had trained or were in the process of training end-of-life companions, purely because they recognise the importance of having someone who can be there with patients who are dying when no one else can. Now, the staff do a great job, but they're busy. Family and friends do a great job, but they cannot always be there. Some people don't have family and friends. So there's this gap, and end-of-life companions slot in as someone who can be with someone who's dying. I think it's very deep in the human psyche, this need to think that no one should die alone, unless, of course, they want to. And often people do slip away. But having that offer of presence with you for as long as you need it, is just essential human care and compassion. So lots of hospitals were doing this anyway. Unfortunately, the downside is with the pandemic and infection controls and things, a lot of those volunteers are now not able to go in. So I'm not sure what the picture is now, but we hope for the future that these programs will start again. In addition, of course, people die at home. They die in nursing homes. The need is the same. Family can be there, but they can't be there 24/7 probably. And to have someone who can slip in, fill that gap, is just such a blessing. And in terms of the bereavement as well, you know, if you've lost a loved one and you know that somebody was with them when they died, that is a very comforting feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's worth saying that a lot of care staff in whatever capacity do go above and beyond, don't they? So, you know, even in the absence of such an end-of-life companionship program, I think even, you know, they don't just draw a hard line at the professional nature of care. I've seen many, many carers that go way, way beyond that and invest a lot of their own personal time too. So it's clearly something that on a human level, we find so important, we're willing to dedicate our spare time to it, aren't we?
I think that's why they signed up. It's because they care for people. They want to be with people. And one of the big frustrations is when busyness or PPE or anything else becomes a barrier to giving that care that they so long to give.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I from a distance know about the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, because obviously this is a partnership. And I believe you're aiming to train up some 500 companions over the next couple of years, the length of the program. Tell us a bit about that link up and why it's important to partner with a charity and organization that actually knows this work well.
I think it's a starting place. If you want to volunteer as an end-of-life companion in hospital or in any other setting, where do you begin? You know, you ring the hospital, they say, oh yeah, okay, well, who are you? The Society of St. Vincent de Paul has got a very strong foundation. It was established with this vision to care for those who needed care most. So it's well set up to launch people into this ministry.
I know, Lynn, that you've obviously been involved in the writing of the end-of-life companionship training program, because of course people need a little bit of training for such things. So I suppose the obvious and rather big question is, what does it take to be an end-of-life companion?
Probably a lifetime's experience and a lot of resilience and a lot of compassion. It's not for everybody. Undoubtedly, people will maybe feel called, undertake some training, feel more called, and pursue it and succeed, and they'll be fabulous. Other people will be not so sure, and they may or may not feel called, but they will perhaps tap into this training. This is only introductory training, we have to say, which gives an overview of what it's like to. What's it like to die? But what's it like to be with somebody who is dying? How do we employ our own spirituality? And how do we draw on the great traditions of Catholic and SVP spirituality to bring that to the bedside? And then how do we slot into that funny little gap between what the professionals are doing, what the family members are doing, and what the person wants? So that's the kind of structure of this little program. They're going to train online, obviously, because we do everything online these days. And then there will be, or during that training and after, there'll be a period of discernment to see whether that they feel that this is something that they can undertake.
Do you know, you made me think a bit there, actually. You know, it being a journey to being an end-of-life companion on the whole, I would think, not just flicking a switch and going, ah, bang, light bulb moment, I'm going to be an end-of-life companion. I suppose you'd also, on the other side, from patients, get that feeling of, oh, I don't want somebody sitting with me at the end. I've worked out what I want, and that's not what I want. I'm okay on my own. This is the path I want to take. But they might also, of course, because it's a journey, maybe not want that, because somebody might be saying, well, I don't want to access that, or I don't want a person with me, when actually they do. Is that a factor that comes into it?
Yes, and none of it's static. So if you don't want somebody with you at 9 o'clock in the morning, it doesn't mean you don't want somebody with you at 10:30. And hospital patients often do speak of feeling a bit lonely and isolated. It's funny, isn't it? You know, for privacy reasons, if someone's reaching the end of their life, we tend to draw the curtains round or put them in a private room if we can. Seems reasonable, doesn't it? But the downside to that is, of course, that they feel shut away. If people don't pop in, you know, staff will pop in, obviously, all the time. But it's often noted that when somebody is not having active treatment anymore, the doctors don't come round so often. People sometimes feel like, you know, they've been let go. There's no more we can do for you is the term that people often cite. And of course, it's not true. The staff are very much there for them, but they've got other commitments. And what seems like a very long day from a hospital bed seems like a very short day when you're caring for 20 or 30 patients. Family members can come in. Let's not think about COVID times, but normally, you know, it's very acceptable for a family member to stay in the room by the bed. But with the best will in the world, they need to look after themselves. They need to get some sleep. They need to get some food. They need to get fresh air. So there are times when they need to leave. Now, we don't want to overcrowd the patient. So it's really, really sensitive. People give mixed messages. You know, 1 minute they'll say, oh, no, I'm fine. I don't want anyone. Just leave me in peace. 10 minutes later, they'll be saying, oh, there's nobody there. It's really about availability and then sensing what's right. So the more people you've got who can be available, it's very easy to step outside if the person doesn't want you. But it's far easier it's far more difficult to find somebody at short notice if the person suddenly does. Can I tell you a story? Oh, well, I'll tell you a story if you like. And it's a memory that's come back from the hospice for me. I visited a lady in a room and she was fine and we had a really pleasant conversation and it ended perfectly normally and I left. And I was absolutely astounded about probably no more than 10 minutes later to see this lady out in the lounge area being comforted by a nurse. And in that ensuing time, I don't think it was anything I did, but in that ensuing time between me leaving the room and her being perfectly fine, she suddenly had this vision that she hadn't seen her family for ages and ages and they were never coming again and she felt isolated and alone. And she was just beside herself with distress. She came flying out into the unit and it didn't take long to calm her and pacify her. The nurse was amazing. She was just so still, so silent. And the lady settled quite quickly, but it stayed with me as a memory. And it's just perhaps an instance of how quickly people's circumstances can change and their sense of isolation can suddenly overwhelm them. And that's why it's just lovely to have spare people around who are appropriately trained, who have the appropriate disposition to fill that gap when needed.
It's obvious the merits of the companionship programme for those that either don't have family or family aren't visiting or friends, etc. But then for those where they do have a family member or a friend or a number of them, as you say, there is that downtime. Is there a circumstance, do you foresee, where the companion is not only a companion to the person who's dying, but also potentially those that are visiting that person who might be beside themselves as well and not coping very well either?
I think very much so. I mean, the whole principle of palliative care is that we're there for the person and those close to them. And there's no distinction, you know, the care is for the family unit or the friendship unit. There's a million dynamics of family by the bedside and positive and sometimes not quite so positive. And having someone there who can gently coax those dynamics along is really helpful. So the companion's going to have several roles. And the first role will probably be to step back when family are there to say, well, shall I leave you alone? Because that's the natural thing to do. But there are other things as well. And they may well say, no, no, it's fine, stay. Because actually for family members, it's quite hard to think of conversations to have with someone who's frail and in a bed. And a companion can nurture those. So you can talk about, you can talk with the relative about the person. Tell me about the person. Tell me, oh, when did you meet? And whereabouts do you live? And in that conversation, the sick person can participate as much or as little as they like. What's going on around their bedside is a very affirming conversation about, carefully guided, about their life. And hopefully will conjure up sort of good memories in their minds.
Yeah. And in terms of a few sort of statistics, you know, I think round about one in two die in hospital, one in six in a care home, but also significantly one in five at home, which is quite a reasonable number. I think you alluded to this at the very beginning, but will companions go to people's houses if they choose to die there?
They certainly will be willing to. And I think here, I think you alluded to it a bit earlier, this thing about people being very good at saying, oh no, I don't need anybody, we're okay, we're managing, putting on a brave face. I think there will be a period of easement about people feeling confident about inviting people into their houses. And again, I think this is an SVP advantage because they're established in the parish. They're also well established in local communities. So they come with a track record. Oh, we knew them because they were phoning Auntie Sue for years before she became ill. We knew them because they're the people that sort people out when they haven't got any furniture, when they move into a home. You know, we knew them because. So I think that gives the SVP an established credibility. The home environment is different from a healthcare environment. It's where the person lives. So hospitality-wise, you are even more on their territory than you would be, say, in a hospital. But the needs of the family or carers are much the same or more, because they need to carry on with the everyday life. They need to cook and clean and do all the duties and get out and get some air, please. So a companion there, I think, slots into that sort of relief role of, well, if I come in between two and four, then you can have that as downtime and you'll know that I'm there. You don't have to go out. You don't have to not be with the person in their room, but you do know that you've got a bit of space. I could tell you another story.
I like your stories. Go on, please do.
I went out with hospice at home once to a lady who was dying at home, and she was a mum. She was, I don't know, maybe she was in her 50s. She was about the same age as me at that time. Her full-time carer was her daughter, who was 18, and she was fabulous. She was totally committed. She slept on her mum's sofa. She was there for her mum at all time. The love she showed was just humbling to see. But she needed a little space, you know, as she needed time just to walk down the garden path, time to phone her friends, maybe do a little bit of FaceTime. Plus, of course, the usual things of needing the time to do the household duties, the washing, the cooking, the cleaning, etc., etc. And she was just so grateful for a companion to go in and be with mum so that she could, and this is the thing I remember, I think she used to say, just walk down the garden path and breathe some air.
Yeah, do you know, you remind me with that story actually of my earlier days as a journalist, where I ended up going to a weekend getaway, if you like, for young carers. I didn't even know particularly the numbers of young people caring for their maybe their mum, their dad, their relatives, their older relatives. Some as young as, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11. I mean, it really honestly, it's so moving. I think I spent some of that time crying. I don't mind admitting that, although it was rather difficult. But the strength of these young people was absolutely incredible, far stronger than I'd ever imagine I could be. So, you know, that lovely point you made about just simply getting some air in your lungs, walking down the garden path, might seem like a small thing for some people, but when you're in that care situation and it's pretty intense and pretty 24/7, that is just so valuable. So we've got 2 years potentially of the companionship program. In an ideal world, which of course it isn't, what would you say would be a measure of success for this program?
Success would be seeing 500 or so people in their local communities, not necessarily doing massive amounts, but doing something for people in the community, in the neighbourhood, in their parish, and in their families. And I think somewhere there's a figure that we maybe would hope that everyone accompanies at least 3 people by the end of that time. You know, let's not get too caught up with figures. Let's just think about the whole evolution of this death and dying program, the huge education job that we need to do with so many people who really still have little experience of being with the dying. Bereavement need is just spiraling because of the numbers that are dying at the moment. So being able to companion people who've had a recent loss, somebody who knows a little bit about what dying is like, to be with a bereaved person afterwards, there is just going to be so much need in this coming year that if we can train as many, there will be places where they can really add wonderful support. And that's what I'd like to see.
Excellent. Yes, me too. And of course, everyone talks about the vaccine being the light at the end of the tunnel and the exit from the pandemic. But also, as you say, that there are bigger issues at stake and more long term involving people's mental health and well-being. And therefore, we in some way would hope that companionship would, of course, help those that have found themselves bereaved and had loved ones die. Lynn, thank you so much. Really kind of you to give me your time. And I hope you'll give us an update. We, you know, this is an ongoing project. So will you please come back and tell us a bit more further down the line?
We'll be absolutely delighted to come back and tell you when it's up and running and things are happening. It's going to be very, very exciting. And I'll be thrilled to give you some more time.
Why not subscribe to the Art of Dying Well podcast? Just search for the Art of Dying Well on iTunes, Stitcher or TuneIn.
Yes, do please subscribe so we can stay close to your ears every couple of months. We'd be absolutely delighted if you do just that. Big thank you to Dr. Lynn Bassett, who we've just heard from there, for giving us an introduction to our End of Life Companions programme, partnering with the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. Now, this is a multi-guest podcast, 4 to be precise, and our next guest is the broadcaster Julie Etchingham, who we heard from, of course, on our last Art of Dying Well podcast, when we were talking about COVID-19 and the ins and outs of reporting on the pandemic as a journalist. Julie has been really supportive of our End of Life Companions programme, and as a frontline broadcaster, lent us her skills to the training aspect of the programme, interviewing End of Life Companions and helping to sharpen up those crucial communication skills. Let's find out a little bit more.
It was a real privilege to be asked to do it, actually. So the amazing woman who runs the Centre for the Art of Dying Well, Maggie Doherty, is a very dear friend of mine, asked me whether I'd do the interviews to help with the training course. And I said, well, yes, of course I will. I'm always happy to do things for Maggie. I suppose I didn't really think about it a great deal before I did the interviews, but then I started doing the research ahead of doing these interviews. And the idea is that those members of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, you know, it's a society, Catholic society, which I think it was first established in 1833, really to support, you know, the destitute, people who've come out of prison and are trying to, you know, they walk the path in compassionate solidarity with those who need it most. And my father used to be a member and do their work in his parish. So I've got very clear memories of it growing up. So the idea is now that members of the SVP, as it's known, are going to train to be end-of-life companions. And this is in conjunction with the Centre for the Art of Dying Well. So as part of that training, there are a series of interviews that the trainees can listen into. And they were with a whole range of people. They were with a professor of palliative care from Liverpool University, a Muslim end-of-life doula who was an end-of-life companion. We spoke to somebody from Marie Curie. We spoke to a volunteer who goes into hospitals to give families some support, as well as the support of those who are reaching the end of their lives. And as a result of doing those interviews, it really opened my eyes as to how important this work is and how important it is to do it professionally and to do it really with a great deal of forethought and training and care, I suppose. So it was great to be able to speak to these people and get an insight into what that work entails, really. If you're going to be an end-of-life companion, you're just walking that path with somebody. And sometimes that means they need practical help. And sometimes it means that they need spiritual uplift. Some people aren't religious and just need companionship. And the companionship in the end is what counts in all of those settings. And I suppose the thing that really impresses me most about those who do this work, it is that sort of just the presence of a person. Just to be there, sometimes that's all it takes. You don't need to be a clinician. There are aspects of everybody's personalities that are valuable in people's last days and hours. And I was just really impressed by those who are already doing the work.
Yeah. And we spoke to Lynn Bassett about this. You know, it may be that you do have family and friends around you, but they need a break from time to time. You know, they need to catch their breath and get some rest, whatever else it might be. Now, we're family people, so the chances are we hopefully will have someone around us when we die. But have you sort of considered that, well, actually, it might be quite nice to have someone a little bit detached from the family and close friends situation, where I might be able to talk about things that, you know, because you worry about how that impacts on your family, don't you? Everything you say at that point, you're going to be slightly assessing, oh, I don't want to leave them feeling like this. I don't want them to feel like that. Perhaps that mechanism is a good thing. Is it the sort of thing you consider having at the end?
Gosh, I was in that classic way. I actually haven't thought about it that closely, but I can absolutely see the value in it. Because I suppose from the point of view that if one were ever in the deeply unhappy position of, you know, your children still being quite young or, you know, just starting out in life. I mean, my husband lost his father when he was 21. You'd be very conscious of how they were experiencing that. So I can imagine having a slightly more objective person to talk to and to really just to think things through with or say things out loud. I can imagine that's enormously valuable. And also to know that you're giving your family a bit of a break from the intensity of perhaps being at a bedside, you know, just allowing them to go and get some fresh air or do the practical stuff that they need to do, get to the shops, you know, all of that stuff has to go on. That was one of the things that really struck me about this role of being an end-of-life companion, is that you can be almost whatever the person who is at the end of their life needs to be. And it's being sensitive and alive and alert to that.
Do you know, that's such classic projection from me there. I've been thinking about the end of my life, obviously, and I've just thrown that onto you to see if you have the same thoughts.
I think actually one of the experiences of this pandemic is that it has forced us all to think about it. You know, even if we're in good health with good prospects, a good scenario, we know that this could strike anywhere with our families. So there won't be a single person who hasn't contemplated it. And that's why I think this podcast is so wonderful, because actually it's so right for the moment that we're living in, I think, because there isn't a person who won't have considered it or experienced it, you know. And I think that's what we've got to take on as a society as well, that in the coming months, please God, when the figures start to improve, is how we move forward with this level of bereavement in society and trauma. And what we do with that and how we accommodate that and how we renew our understanding of how that's going to shape our society, I think is going to be crucial.
Absolutely right. Thank you very much, Julie. You know, it's really uplifting that we've got so many gifted people giving their time to support this excellent initiative. I hope you're enjoying this Art of Dying Well podcast, by the way. But we're not quite done yet, as it is now time for...
The Voice from the Chaplain's Chair.
So the voice from the chaplain's chair comes once again from Father Mark Paver, a Catholic priest of the Salford Diocese, hospital chaplain, relatively new to the role. And today we're talking about end-of-life accompaniment. And I'd just like to ask you, Father Mark, you know, walking with the sick, and I know, of course, doctors and nurses, what skills do you think you need specifically as a priest in order to accompany people at the end of life?
Well, it's a good question, James. I mean, I think it's certainly the defining characteristic, I would say, of this kind of ministry, at least for me, is that sense of walking with someone. And very often that psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd," is the most appropriate prayer, really, to take into various different situations. You can't underestimate the need for a certain degree of human, I suppose, interaction, particularly when it comes to approaching people who are sick in bed and also being with their families if the circumstances have deteriorated. And that would be when I would see families in the current time. It would only be really when the circumstances have deteriorated quite badly for the patient. It would be towards end of life situations. It's very difficult in those situations to have the words to say. So I would suggest it's probably taken me and is still taking me some time to work out how best to sort of comport myself in those moments. But over time, I would suggest fewer words are probably better than many words. I don't think the families and the patients are necessarily looking for answers. They're looking for a sense of presence with them. And not necessarily my presence, again, as an individual, but the presence of the faith that they've followed all their lives. And then I think also a sense of calmness is important, to be calm in those moments, because everything else is failing. You know, the body is failing in front of us. Science has failed to get us where we want it to get us to. There's a danger that everything will fall apart. So you want to be the one who says, it's okay still. It's still okay. No matter what happens here, it's still okay. Because this person before us is a beloved child of God. And I want him or her to hear that. We all want to say that together, you know, if the family's around at that point.
Have you had those circumstances where you've had to calm someone who perhaps is struggling to reconcile themselves with the fact that scientific component, the medicine has not taken them to a prolonged life, and, you know, the inevitability of knowing that they're going to meet death?
Yeah, I think there's been one or two moments over the time, not necessarily specifically to do with COVID, but where, yeah, the news has just been broken to a family that treatment isn't going to be successful. And we're often called at that point. But tribute to the medical team in the hospital where I work, they're very clear with patients. They themselves are very calm about what's happening. It doesn't take away the upset and the panic, but the clarity they receive allows them to at least start from a place. And as a priest, you enter into that situation confident that at least you know what place this family is in. I don't try to give them answers that are beyond my competence. Well, most families don't want to talk beyond the immediate at this moment. So it's foreseeable that somebody might ask, you know, why is God doing this? I've been quite fortunate not had that type of situation. If it were to come, I'm sure there are hospital chaplains listening to this who've had it many times. Perhaps they'll send me their answers.
You mentioned family members there, and I guess, you know, I'm probably guilty of thinking just of the dying person at that point. But do you get family members coming to you saying, well, look, you know, I'm maybe in non-COVID times, I'm around quite a lot. I want to be a good accompanier from a family perspective of my loved one, but I'm struggling a bit here myself. Do you ever have to say to them, you know, calm them down and help them minister in a family sense to the patient?
Yeah, I suppose we do in a way. And again, from my own particular tradition, of course, the Catholic Church has a well-established practice for end-of-life care for a patient. And ultimately, the essence of that is to hear once again how precious the patient is in the eyes of God. So I want the patient to hear that as much as possible. One of the sadnesses, I suppose, is that very often we're called, and at the point we're called, the patient's already no longer conscious, still alive, but no longer conscious, usually because of the pain relief drugs that they're receiving. But I still assume they can hear, and I still give that message. And where possible, I hope the family's around to hear the same message. And then I like to encourage them at that point to cherish the time, to cherish the time that's left with their loved one, to take these moments to make sure nothing's left unsaid, you know, assuming that the person can still hear, even if they can't react to what's being said. And that's how I like to leave families, with that message. You know, they've done what they can for the patient. The staff has done what they can in the hospital. They've given them the gift of the church by calling the priest to the bedside. And now is the time just to calmly and peacefully just tell the patient how much they loved.
Is a good bedside manner something that comes naturally to a chaplain, or do you need a little bit of training to top up your God-given skills?
Well, James, I would have to say it's, based on my experience, it's not something that comes naturally. I probably should apologise to all the patients that I've seen and not demonstrated good bedside manner. But I think that part of it is being relaxed, actually, and being as human as you can be in the situation that we're in, when patients are probably feeling as least human as they can be, in a sense, because they're being processed, they're being tested every few hours, someone's sticking a needle in to test their different indicators that they need to measure. So they're feeling less like themselves than they would ordinarily do so. And I think what part of what makes them feel human again is seeing a friendly face by the bedside and hearing a prayer that's directed to them specifically by the bed and placing them in God's care. But yeah, it's probably something I'll be working on for the rest of my life, that, James.
And from your Catholic tradition, as you mentioned, people, I'm sure, can be quite scared when they hear phrases like last rites. Might call it sacrament of the sick, of course, but a lot of people know it as the last rites, which sounds somewhat terrifying, doesn't it, in a sense. How do you sort of bring comfort and reconciliation in what I'm sure you would say is a very important time?
You're absolutely right, James. And, you know, there have been situations where a patient is still aware enough of what's going on, and the family at some point has requested a priest, and yet when the priest arrives, there's a sense that the patient doesn't want to see the priest. You know, they've said, oh, I'm not at that stage, I don't need a priest at this point. And at that point, you know, it sort of makes your heart sink a little, because it's not only about the very end of your life. You know, we want you to know you're loved by God no matter what's going to happen next. You know, we hope you get healthy again, and this sacrament is here to strengthen you through that. And I always like to place it in the context of the sacramental economy, if you like to use a technical phrase, but in the context of all of the sacraments of the church. And that's something that this time, these past 10 months has led me to reflect on, that above all, what are the sacraments there for? Well, they're there to tell us that God loves us. They're there for us to touch and to feel and to taste his love for us, because, you know, he's an immaterial being. So it's making material something that's immaterial, in a sense. Whenever I'm giving someone the sacrament of the sick, I always kind of begin with a little narrative about that. This isn't anything to worry about. It doesn't mean to say anything particular is going to happen. It's just another reminder of God's love for you. We want you to hear that you are a beloved son or daughter of God.
Thank you very much indeed, Father Mark Paver, not just for this contribution, but for your wisdom and insight over two podcasts now. Much consolation to be taken from those words. Right, that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for listening, and indeed getting to this wrap-up point after rather a long, but I sincerely hope you'll agree, interesting podcast. Remember to visit our website for more on the End of Life Companionship Programme. We're at www.artofdyingwell.org. And you can find out more about the fine work that the Society of St. Vincent de Paul are doing over at www.svp.org.uk. Big thanks to Dr. Glenys Caswell, Dr. Lynn Bassett, Julie Etchingham, and our chaplain, Father Mark Paver. Sterling contributions, one and all. Thank you so much. Just remains for me to say that until next time, I hope you all stay safe. But remember, if you're lying there, sitting, standing, walking, whatever you're doing, we're in your corner, and remain fully committed to keeping this vital conversation going. Bye for now.